Here we go. All right. I'll do my intro once again. This is Imar Selportute, and welcome to another edition of the Sports Inquirer podcast. Sorry I haven't been with y'all for a little while. Had a lot going on in my professional and social world, but glad to be back here with you on a Sunday evening. Got a lot to talk about on tonight's show. Going to discuss some mixed martial arts, NFL. We're in free agency period, and a little bit of a preview of the upcoming draft. NBA in full swing post All-Star break, so a lot to discuss there. Just going to discuss the Winter Olympics and some other fun topics in the world of sports. But first, let's get to our sponsors. We're brought to you always by thesportsinquirer.net, the premier site for news and notes in the world of sports. You can follow it on Twitter under Sports Inquirer, all one word. Also on Facebook under The Sports Inquirer. And subscribe to the podcast that you're listening to now on iTunes under The Sports Inquirer. Also brought to you by thestartinglineup.net, an excellent sports site and radio show based out of Chicago. I'm doing some content for them as well and appearing on some shows. So go over to the website, show them your support. We're going to take our first break, and when we come back, we're going to delve into mixed martial arts here on the podcast. Welcome back to the show. Your host once again, E. Marcel Portute. Since it's been such a long time since I've actually done a podcast for you, I figured the best way for me to break things down would be do a power rankings. And I think through that, you'll get all of my thoughts on the world of mixed martial arts. Let's jump right into it and start with the heavyweight division. My top five, number one is Cain Velasquez, followed by Junior Dos Santos, Travis Brown, Fabricio Werdum, and Antonio Bigfoot Silva. Cain is dealing with some injuries. He's not going to fight until the latter half of this year, which really leaves the division in a little bit of an influx position, allowing the next four guys to really battle it out to find out who is the true number one contender for the title. Junior Dos Santos has faced Velasquez three times, come out on the short end the last two times, so he's really in a limbo position, meaning that it looks like he is going to be a guy who is not going to get a title shot for a long time, but he's still my number two heavyweight fighter because I think he will beat all of the other guys on my list. Travis Brown is going to face Werdum later on, I think in the next few months. That's going to be a major fight for the Hawaiian. I like Brown as a prospect. He's had some really impressive wins over Overeem and some other top contenders. Werdum, a Brazilian, excellent ground fighter. He's really elevated his career as well and is keeping himself in that position for a title shot. And Bigfoot Silva is my number five guy. Light heavyweight, we'll go in order it once again. The UFC champion John Jones is number one, followed by Alex Gustafson, Rashad Evans, Phil Davis, and Glover Teixeira. Jones is obviously the top guy, has beaten all of his major top contenders for the title, arguably the best fighter in the world, especially with the retirement of Joyce St. Pierre. But I was really impressed with Gustafson last night, got a second round TKO to win his fight in London. I really thought he won that fight over John Jones when they faced off a few months ago. And it was confirmed by Zuffa that Gustafson is going to get the winner of the Jones Teixeira fight, which is going to take place in a few months in Baltimore. I like Teixeira. I think he's on a 20-win fight streak or in that range. Excellent striker. Has really improved his game over time. I don't think he's going to give Jones as much of a challenge as some other guys that are on my list, but Teixeira is deserving of a title shot, and it's going to be right there for the championship. Rashad Evans, my number three man. I was really looking forward to his fight against Daniel Cormier that got canceled due to an injury to Evans. Evans looked really... I liked how he performed against Chael Sonnen. If we got that Rashad Evans in his fight against John Jones 2 years ago, or actually right here in Atlanta, I think Jones may have gone down that night. But Evans, for whatever reason, was very passive in his fight against Jones and obviously lost that fight. He's still my number three ranked person right now, but that can definitely... he can move down very quickly in my ranking, especially if he's out due to injury. Phil Davis, number four. I love that fight against Anthony Rumble Johnson coming up at light heavyweight. Johnson, who in the past has struggled to make weight and be competitive at welterweight and middleweight, I love him at light heavyweight in that 205-pound range. Minimal weight cutting for him by his standards. He's going to be a strong fighter in that contest. Phil Davis, once again, got that decision win over Lyoto Machida, but was not overly impressive in that bout. I think a win over Anthony Johnson can get him right back in that title picture to face the winner of Gustafson, who's going to face the winner of Jones and Teixeira. So a light heavyweight picture is actually looking pretty solid and looks like it's going to form. A division that doesn't look like it's in form or in order is the middleweight division, which is my next category. Chris Weidman, UFC champion there. He's my number one fighter. I still have Anderson Silva number two. I think that's more out of respect for his body of work that he performed over the past few years. But he is definitely potentially falling down the list due to inactivity. Now, if he comes back within the calendar year and performs at a high level, then his number two ranking may not be as in much jeopardy as it is currently right now as we speak in March. But number three is Vitor Belfort. And we'll get to Vitor later on. It is the controversy with testosterone replacement therapy, TRT, and I'll break that down towards the end of my analysis. But right now, he's number three. Arnaldo Sosa is number four, and Lyoto Machida is number five. Well, we'll get to the middleweight situation right now. So for those of you maybe not as familiar with mixed martial arts and testosterone replacement therapy, here is kind of your Cliff Notes breakdown, Google-ized version of it. The situation is that certain fighters such as Vitor Belfort, Chael Sonnen, and a handful of others were taking testosterone replacement therapy, meaning that whatever their normal level of testosterone is, and I'm not going to give you the specifics of the numbers of it's 1.0, or, well, we'll just, okay, hypothetically, we'll do it that way. Say your testosterone normally is at 1.0, what a normal human being is for a male, and you're tested and your testosterone readings come out to 0.5. Some fighters have received exemption to take testosterone to get their levels back to 1.0 so that they can be competitive in a mixed martial arts fight. Now, with any other professional sport, you're going to have fighters who potentially have taken advantage of the situation and have maneuvered their testosterone replacement to get an advantage. So, prime example, maybe Vitor Belfort. Normally, if you tested him, maybe his testosterone is 1.3. And then all of a sudden, you test him a few months before a fight, and he's at 0.5. He takes his therapy, he gets up to 1.3. Now, in reality, maybe his testosterone should be at a lower or higher level than what he did under that initial test. So that by the time he takes his therapy, he's at a much higher level than a normal male fighter should be, or female fighter if you go to that category. So the reality is that in the past few weeks, I think last week actually, there was a ruling by the Nevada Athletic Commission, or Las Vegas, it's Nevada Athletic Commission, that's the state. They ruled that testosterone replacement therapy, TRT, will not be used in mixed martial art fights, and that includes the UFC, obviously. So as a result of that, Vitor Belfort, who was scheduled to fight Chris Weidman for the UFC Middleweight Championship in a few months, he actually pulled out of the fight. Because for him to actually stop using his testosterone replacement and to get back to a normal fighting level, to be competitive, actually be able to fight in a contest without using his therapy, that's going to take several months. And if you read reports and listen to doctors and scientists, they say it may take years if he wants to get back to be a normal fighter not using TRT. So the result is that Lyoto Machida, who had, I thought, was a solid victory over George Musashi, he is actually going to fight Chris Weidman for the title. And we'll get to that fight analysis when we get closer to the event. But major letdown that Vitor Belfort, who is one of the original OGs of mixed martial arts, was not able to do that fight. But the rules are the rules. And I think when we get into my preview of UFC 171, I'll delve more into that testosterone replacement treatment and discuss it a little bit further. We're just going to move on right now with my MMA rankings and get to the welterweights. We'll go over my top five. One is Johnny Hendricks. Two, Carlos Condit. Three is Robbie Lawler. Rory McDonald comes in the fourth spot. And Jake Shields, number five. I had to take George St. Pierre off of my list. Obviously, if he was still an active fighter, he would be in my top five without question. But since he has retired or taken an extended leave of absence, he is off my list until further notice. The man I thought that beat St. Pierre in his last fight, Johnny Hendricks, takes over my top spot. And he's going to face Robbie Lawler, who is in my number three position, and that fight is this Saturday. We're going to delve, I said, in the next podcast, delve specifically into several of those fights on that fight card. But right now, Hendricks looks like a man who is going to be poised to be atop of the division for the foreseeable future. Carlos Condit is going to face Tyrone Woodley this Saturday as well. Woodley is a tremendously physically talented fighter, who has really gained more experience over time. Carlos Condit is the more experienced fighter, but that's another fight I'll delve into a lot more over the next podcast. But we're looking forward to that contest. Robbie Lawler finally getting that UFC title shot. If Vitor is an OG, then Robbie Lawler is right there along with them. So that's going to be a really fun contest. Rory McDonald barely got past Damian Maia. I thought that McDonald still a young fighter. I think that the hype train for him was very high, especially after his dismantling of BJ Penn last year on a Fox card. And you really saw McDonald take a step back in a major way with his loss to Robbie Lawler and a devastating knockout defeat. But he got past Damian Maia, and the next step for him is going to, I don't know who's fighting next. I don't know if it's officially been announced yet, but he is working his way back up the title picture. And I believe he's only 24 or 25 years old, so he has plenty of time to get his career back on track. And Jake Shields is my number five fighter. A lot of you fans or followers of mixed martial arts may want to see Ben Askren in my top five. Similar to St. Pierre, lack of activity presently is preventing me from putting him in the top five. Now, he's going to fight, I believe, in Japan for a promotion out there. And I'm not sure what it is. Email me or contact me. If you know what, I know what it is, but I'm going to keep the show moving and flow with it. But once he gets to that promotion, if he does well, or maybe gets onto World Series of Fighting, whatever he decides to do, and shows more activity, he is a top five, I think, welterweight fighter when he's active and is fighting. But for the time being, he is outside of my top five. And we're going to move on to the lightweight division, my last ranking. Anthony Pettis is my number one fighter, the UFC lightweight champion. Ben Henderson is number two, Gil Melendez three, Josh Chomps Thompson four, and Eddie Alvarez is number five. Pettis, another fighter dealing with an injury. I don't know when he is going to have his title defense, and when that happens, I'm probably going to see him face Benson Henderson, who won a close decision over Josh Thompson. I personally, when I was scoring the fight and looking at it, I thought Ben Henderson won the fight in a relatively, not easy fashion, but convincing. I think I had 3-2 or 4-1. But looking at other writers and the social media, Facebook and Twitter, a lot more people had Thompson winning the fight. I may have to look at that fight once again to give a second or maybe even a third look at those rounds to see if Thompson really won that fight. But right now, in my ranking, he's number four. Gil Melendez is number three, and I said Eddie Alvarez is number five. And it looks like he is going to fight Michael Chandler for the third time in Bellator in the near future. TJ Grant, one of my favorite rising prospects in the division. Unfortunately, he is not in my top five due to injuries. He has not been able to fight nearly a year now. And he was supposed to fight for the title against Benson Henderson when he had the belt. But he got hurt in that situation. And he maybe was going to fight Pettis in the near future. But TJ Grant got hurt again. He really has struggled with the injuries. And that's why he is outside of my top five. And some other MMA news. Gil Melendez almost signed with Bellator. I really would have liked to see that. Give some more depth to the lightweight division. But I believe in the end, he signed back with UFC. I don't know what the numbers are. But it really would have been a nice win for Bellator to get Gil Melendez. I like the Rampage Jackson signing and the Mullawal. And they're going to get it on and fight for the light heavyweight number one contendership in the near future. I really want to see Bellator succeed. I don't have a stock in it. I don't know anybody over there or any situation like that. But as I've always said on the show before, and to some of you out there who listen to me or know me personally, you want promotions to be successful because not only does it build competition for better events, it also gives better fighters opportunities to perform at a higher stage. I don't understand how people want Bellator to fail. Unless you're a UFC employee or have a financial investment in the UFC, you should be encouraging Bellator to succeed. Now, you shouldn't support it if it's a bad product. And Bellator has not been perfect, but I think they've made some good strides in the product they present in and out of the cage. But you should really want them to do well so that not only do fighters have another platform to perform, they can make more money, get better compensated, which usually means you're going to see some better events and just a better product overall. So seeing Gil Melendez almost go to Bellator, I was really excited about that. But when it didn't happen, hey, as long as he's able to feed his family and he feels that he's in the right position right for him to be a competitive fighter, I guess I'm fine with that. Yushin Okami is fighting in World Series of Fighting. Interesting that the World Series of Fighting is making their steps as well. They're a product that's a little younger than Bellator and obviously younger than UFC. And I can see some improvements they can make in and outside of the ring. But this is the right step for them to make as far as building their product. Yushin Okami, solid middleweight. Not necessarily a title contender in the UFC, but is a recognizable name who will give some respectability to that fight promotion. So I was glad to see that happen. And as I said, we're going to preview UFC 161 on Wednesday. We're going to delve into some of the fights specifically. And as I said, I'll delve a little bit more into the TRT issue in mixed martial arts, which in essence can be considered a performance-enhancing drug. And if you're a sports fan listening to this podcast, no matter what sport you follow, PEDs have been a major topic in your sport over the past decade or two. So while you may not like mixed martial arts or be a fan of it or familiar with it, I think you can relate as a spectator of a sport dealing with performance-enhancing drugs. We're going to take a break here, and when I come back, I'm going to delve into some NFL news here on the podcast. We're kind of an in-between period here in the NFL offseason. NFL Combine just took place, and dealing with all that happened there, free agency starts officially tomorrow or on Monday if you're listening to the show a little bit later. they'll start off with the combine. I'm not going to get into specifics of the actual combine itself, the risers and fallers. We're going to delve into the NFL draft a lot more over the next month or so. Maybe we'll get Condor Addison back on the show. He was a really good draft analyst for us last year. I'm going to try to get him to come back again so we can break down this class. But it was interesting as a 32-year-old man, or 33, excuse me, turning 33 soon, early 30s gentleman, watching the NFL Combine on NFL Network and thinking back to when I was a younger fan in the 90s and even the early 2000s, and you would hear about the Combine and all of the drills and the interviews and all the evaluation periods, but not really getting the specifics of what happens and what goes on. It's interesting how technology, especially the NFL Network, has been a major contributor at NFL.com for those watching the Combine online, and how that's really affected our perception of the draft and of our teams. As a New York Giants fan growing up, I always knew like what the Giants needed in that year, whether it was a tight end or a receiver, maybe some help on the O-line or D-line, things like that. But I really didn't have much analysis to give of other teams and what their needs are and what's important to them. Now, with the combine and having that information, I can look at Houston Texans and see that, okay, they need help on the defensive line, or they need a quarterback with Matt Schaub not performing up to his ability last season. Do they go with a Blake Bortles or Terry Bridgewater or Johnny Manziel? Maybe they take a chance on Davion Clowney to put him on the same defensive line as J.J. Watt and have maybe the best front four in the NFL. Maybe they go offensive line to protect the quarterback that they can get later in the draft. Maybe they go with Jake Matthews. You see what I'm saying? That you go down the line, and having that knowledge of what other teams are doing really puts, first of all, it's made a career out of guys like Matt Mayock and Mel Kiper and Todd McShay. Those guys have, and I respect their hustle, because they have provided a need for a product that is underutilized. And really, that's what business is all about. That's business 101 right there. Provide a product that gives, that solves a need that is underappreciated or underused. And Kiper and the rest of those analysts do a good job with that. So I was just thinking about that when I was watching the combine and seeing everything that was going down, how it's also put more pressure on the evaluators or the teams, because no more do you have the fans who are ignorant only to what you're doing. For example, the Houston Texans, 30 years ago, you watched some college football, you may have read some press clippings of a certain guy. And if whatever Houston Texans, their choice was made, you may criticize it, but you really didn't have much analysis to back it up. No matter who the Texans take at that number one pick, their fans and followers of the NFL are going to have opinions of a varying degree, positively or negatively, because of the increased resource of information. And I thought that watching Combine take place a few weeks ago brought that to home for me. Jim Harbaugh almost going to the Cleveland Browns. Interesting situation there. Jim Harbaugh been with the 49ers 3 years, two NFC Championship games, one Super Bowl appearance, really developed the 49ers into one of the premier teams in the NFL over his three-year period with the team. However, they've really struggled to get a contract extension out of them. Have Colin Kaepernick dealing with trying to get him extended. They have a lot of players who are going to be that need to be signed for the future, and it's all coming to a head for York and the 49ers front office and the ownership. I'm not mad at the Browns for pursuing Jim Harbaugh. Granted, they're going to need to increase their talent level in a significant way to compete for a championship or even compete for a playoff position. But Harbaugh's on a short list of the best coaches in the NFL. If you made a list of a top five, he has to be included. You've had some major instability in the front office with the Cleveland Browns, and having Harbaugh there would be a major help for you in solving those needs. for Jim Harbaugh, I think what happened is, just from outsider looking in, I think they may have done this behind his back and he was unaware of it. Or I'm pretty sure he may have been aware of it, but he was not pursuing this situation. And he's looking at it this way. I'm with the 49ers. I have potential franchise quarterback with me, maybe the best defense in the NFL or on a short list of that. I have draft picks coming up. I have the young squad, and I'm going to be sent off to Cleveland, which arguably has been the worst franchise in the NFL for the past 10 years, or an argument for that. That relationship has been severed, and I think it could be saved by... Well, obviously, money would be a big issue there. Their struggles are going to be trying to re-sign him long-term. You don't want to have him coming into a lame duck year without signing that major contract for him to be there long-term. But I think that relationship in the future is done. He may play out this last season and then put himself out there as a free agent. And there will be more than a dozen franchises, even more, knocking on his door trying to get him to come to their franchise. So watch out for that situation. Free agency is beginning, as I said. We'll probably have some major signings over the next 48 hours, and I'll delve into that on my Wednesday show. Last note in the NFL, Rashad Mendenhall, running back for the Pittsburgh Steelers, he decided to retire at the age of 26. Interesting that he does this, and I'm surprised it does not happen more often. I think I want to say Beanie Wells or another young player retired in his mid-20s. We all assume that when you get to the NFL and you reach that high level, you want to hang on forever and play at the highest level for as long as you can. Obviously, Mendenhall did not envision retiring at 26. He probably wanted to go a little bit further, and obviously you want to be compensated as much as you can, especially in a career like the NFL with such a short shelf life. But there comes a time where players have to realize that physically or mentally, they cannot compete at that high level anymore. Or furthermore, and I think this maybe happened with Mendenhall, I did not read the reasoning for his retirement, so I don't have any first-hand sources on it. For what you're compensated, whether it's $100,000, $500,000, or $10 million, if you feel that your compensation is not worth the long-term effects on your body, mentally and physically, it may not be worth it. For him, it may be a situation where he makes X amount of dollars, and I never tell a man how much he should make. He makes how much he is worth in the open market. If he feels he's worth X amount of dollars and he's not getting that for putting his body on the line, he's had some major injury issues. I know he broke his shoulder. He's probably had some leg issues being a running back. You pile all that together into a career, and sometimes at 26, he may have made enough money to save it, or maybe just move on to the next phase of his life. I completely understand why he does that. And it's interesting because I looked in the past where guys like Barry Sanders and some other guys retired, or maybe left a little earlier than people expected them to. And you saw some critiques on that. It's like, why would he leave early? How dare he be mean, disrespect his teammates and his team by doing this? I think fans and followers are more savvy to how the league works from the player's side, and realize that these players are putting their lives on the line literally every single day, whether it's through practice or playing in the games or training. And it's not like it's... People say, oh, my life is in danger, or this might be the end of me. And mean it in a hypothetical or sarcastic or overtured style way. For NFL players, that's a real situation. Their life is on the line. It does take one hit or one bad play for your life to be altered completely in a negative way. And we all know situations like that. So for Mendenhall to make that move to retire, I respect that, and I'm gonna follow that story a lot more, and maybe look at some other NFL players that retired at a young age and place the value of their life maybe a little bit more than the dollar. I'm gonna take a next break here, and when I come back, I'm going to delve head deep in, or knee deep, or whatever term deep you can say, into the NBA here on the podcast. All right, back here on the podcast, E. Marcel Portute. Once again, to contact us, you can go through several forms. You can contact us on Twitter under Sports Inquirer, all one word. On Facebook under The Sports Inquirer. You can also go to iTunes, subscribe to this podcast under The Sports Inquirer. And also, I forgot to mention earlier, but I'll mention to you now, send us an email under sportsinquirer@gmail.com. If you have some thoughts or comments on this show, if you have some topics you want me to delve into a little further, please send those over to me and I will address them. I'll answer all of your emails and we can definitely get some good dialogue going in relation to the show. Let's delve into the NBA. Let's hold off on an MVP talk. Let the season play itself out. Seems like the post-All-Star break, everyone's starting to make their ballots early as far as who's the most valuable player. Kevin Durant, LeBron James, Blake Griffin, Joakim Noah, Steph Curry, Tony Parker, even Gordon Dragic of the Phoenix Suns. All those guys are viable MVP contenders. Honestly, we all know it's going to come down to Durant or James. Those are two most popular players, two best players in the NBA. It's going to come down maybe to who has the better record, better statistics, who's faced tougher competition. All that stuff is going to go in order. But the overanalysis of it, of just trying to delve into this guy's the MVP, let's hold off on it until the end of the season. Kevin Durant put together a triple-double performance, especially with the absence of Russell Westbrook from earlier in the season. He's MVP. LeBron James put together an excellent 60-point performance against the Bobcats. He's the most valuable player. He's the best ever. Let's hold off on all of that stuff. And quite honestly, I can make a case for Joakim Noah, maybe Steph Curry, Blake Griffin, who I really have enjoyed seeing his evolution with the Clippers. With the absence of Chris Paul, he carried that team to maybe the best team in the NBA during that time period since the start of the calendar year. I can make cases for all of those guys, even Tony Parker. Spurs right up there with the best record in the NBA. Parker's been the most consistent performer during that whole time. I can make a case for him. Gordon Dragic. Now, Jeff Hornacek is probably going to be the runaway coach of the year in the NBA with the Phoenix Suns. But Dragic has been probably their best player with the absence of Eric Bledsoe. So all of those guys have a case to be made. And Joakim Noah, we'll get to the Bulls a little bit later, but he has a major case as well. Let's hold off on all of this analysis and let it play out until the end of the season. The Heat really need to contemplate resting LeBron James more. Now, it happened a few weeks ago, but James hurt his nose facing Oklahoma City, broke his nose, and had to wear the mask, and we saw the drama that came with that. He sat out that Chicago Bulls game that took place in Miami, and the Heat actually won that contest. Now, the Heat end up losing in Chicago in overtime today, and we'll delve into that matchup specifically in my next point or two. But while all of the discussion has been with the as far as resting players, you look at the San Antonio Spurs, who are the masters of it, resting Ginobili, Tim Duncan, Tony Parker, rotating those guys, giving them days of rest to prepare for the stretch run. Russell Westbrook, he's been out with injury, so he got a little bit of a rest. Granted, those to recover from a knee injury, but he still had relatively fresh comparison to other guys. Dwayne Wade, he has been rested throughout the season to have him ready for the postseason. LeBron James needs rest as well. He plays 35 minutes every game, produces close to a triple-double, has to lead the offense, guard the best player on defense, while he has superhuman moments as a player, he's still a human. And that's where Miami, I really think they need to not worry necessarily about getting the one seed or the two seed in the Eastern Conference. I don't think they're really concerned about that. And I know James publicly said he wants to win the MVP, and that's a beautiful thing. And we love that competitiveness out of him as a follower of the game. But I think Miami will be they'll be much better with a well-rested LeBron James towards the end of the regular season and into the playoffs. So you need to consider that. Oklahoma City will be okay. Now, as I talk about this, they just lost on the road to the lowly Los Angeles Lakers and gave up 41 points to Jody Meeks. Oklahoma City is going to be okay in the end, though. The reason I say that, the 42 points to Jody Meeks, got to be statistically accurate. I think they'll be fine in the end. What you have to realize with Oklahoma City is they have either the first or second best player in the NBA in Kevin Durant. but they also have a top 10 player in Russell Westbrook. The problem with Oklahoma City, or not necessarily a problem, but an issue that they have to confront, is that those are two ball-dominant players. And the lesser player, which is not a knock on Westbrook in comparison to Durant, is the one who controls the ball and brings it up the court. If it was the reverse, it'd be a much better situation if Durant was the point guard and Westbrook was the power forward. It'd be a lot better of a situation for them, because Westbrook, while he has to be aggressive offensively, I understand, to get the Oklahoma City offense flowing, you saw today he played 31 minutes in the contest, a person of 42 minutes for Kevin Durant, yet he took 4 more shots than Durant. It was 2 of 10 from 3-point shots and scored 20 points. That should not happen in a game. And granted, I've been on the front line of critiquing Russell Westbrook, saying he holds the ball too much and he shoots too often. But there should not be a game, if both of them are completely healthy and in the flow of things, that Westbrook should shoot more shots than Durant. That should never, ever happen. I mean, it could happen once every 4 or 5 games, but Durant should be shooting a lot more. And furthermore, when you're 7-for-23 from the field, you gotta learn how to pass the ball and get rid of it. And yes, I see that Westbrook had 8 assists, but Durant had 12. And while statistics aren't the main thing or the main thing in analysis when it comes to the sport, especially in basketball, it's a major factor in looking at things. And that's where I see that when Durant scores 27 points in the contest, shoots 8 of 19 from the floor, a little bit below 50%, 10 times better than Russell Westbrook, 7-for-23 from the field. Now, Oklahoma City's gotten a lot better of figuring that dynamic out. I think 2 years ago, when they faced Miami in the finals, that was a bigger problem for them, and this may have been a bump in the road towards them getting to a championship season. But I did not like seeing that performance at all. And obviously giving up 42 points to Jody Meeks should never happen under any circumstances. But I think Oklahoma City in the end is going to be okay. I'm worried about Indiana scoring. They don't get enough fast break points. We know Indiana has an excellent team. Maybe the best defensive team in the NBA. I think it's the second best. And we'll get to the number one team, I think, in about a minute. But I'm worried about their scoring because Paul George, and I saw this when I went to an Indiana Pacers game when they came down here to Atlanta to face the Hawks, he's very slow to start the game. He turns it on in the third quarter, and he'll end up with the proper average around 22, 25 points. But their offense, it plods quite a bit. And I know they have Roy Hibbert, who maybe is the best center in the NBA, and they have to get him involved. And David West, he's another post player. And Lance Stephenson, he's an excellent guard as well. And they have to get him shots. They need to play at a faster pace, I think, for them to succeed as well. Now, will that make them concede a few more points offensively? On the defensive end against their opponent? Yes. But they're going to have to score a lot more. Point is, they're going to have to score in the high 90s or to 100 points to get past Miami. And that's really what it's all about at this stage of the game. That Eastern Conference Finals, which I believe is going to be Indiana and Miami, the Pacers have to increase that offensive flow to have a shot in that series. And I've just seen them have too many plodding offensive efforts against Phoenix, against Houston, and San Antonio this past week. Now, granted, San Antonio and Houston, maybe two of the top 5 teams in the NBA, and they lost them on the road, but that offense really concerned me. So they have to watch out for that. I love Chicago's effort. Saw that Bulls game against Miami, got the win in overtime. DJ Augustine and Jimmy Butler giving them excellent scoring in that backcourt. Jimmy Fredette, I think, is not going to be... he's going to be heard from by the time the season's over. New team, has to get used to the offense. Excellent. He's a good shooter. He's going to give him some good offense as well. But Joakim Noah, maybe my favorite player in the NBA. I don't necessarily have maybe my favorite player to watch play. obviously, seeing Durant and James play when they're going off is great. And Steph Curry's shooting is incredible. Blake has a lot of athleticism and really improved his post game. But for effort and offense and defense, I love seeing Joakim Noah. He's averaging close to 10 assists over the past 5 or 6 games, producing some triple doubles. He may be number 3 on my MVP list at this moment. And that's saying a lot with the competition that I've mentioned. The Bulls are in a dogfight for that number 3 seed with Toronto and Washington. And respect to the Eastern Conference too. Granted, 7 through 8 is terrible. Or maybe I say 5 through 8 is below average. But Toronto has become a respectable team. The Washington Wizards, I almost slipped up and called them the Bullets. I love seeing Bradley Beal and John Wall, seeing those guys perform, bringing a winning product to the nation's capital. Nene's injury hurts them a lot. And while Gortat is a solid center for them, really having Nene and Gortat together gave them an element of inside presence that not a lot of teams can match up with. But Washington is playing really well, so I'm interested to see who gets that 3 seed in that competition. I think the Bulls are going to end up with it. And if the Bulls get Indiana, because I think Miami ultimately is going to win the Eastern Conference, the regular season, watch out for the Bulls against Indiana. I think the Bulls could take that series. Or if they don't take it, it's going to be very, very tough for the Pacers to get past them. San Antonio just needs to make it to the finish line. You're starting to see them turn it on. Kawhi Leonard's been back. He's producing for them off of injury. Tiago Splitter is giving them some solid production in the post. You've seen Danny Green do his thing, and obviously the big three that we all know. San Antonio is going to be right there in the Western Conference Finals against Oklahoma City, or maybe against the Clippers. Watch out for the Spurs. Don't forget about them. And then finally, Houston is a title contender if Omer Asik can buy into the rest of this season. I watched that Indiana's Houston game. Very impressed with the Rockets, James Harden. I forgot to mention him in my MVP candidacy. He has to be in the top 10 if you're making a list. Dwight Howard can make a case for the top 10 as well. After a rough start in Houston and some performances that were very underwhelming by his standards, he has been one of the top 5 players probably in the past 2 months in the NBA. He's been right there in MVP candidacy. I like Houston as well. Their bench concerns me a little bit. And while they may not, it's weird because they score a lot, but I'm still worried about scoring. I'll analyze them a little bit more probably when I get to my NBA notes on Wednesday. But I was really impressed seeing that Houston win over Indiana earlier this week, or late last week. We're going to take our last break, and when I come back, I'm going to delve into miscellaneous news and notes from the world of sports and beyond here on the podcast. Welcome back to the show. I was originally going to do this show a few weeks ago, right when the Winter Olympics ended, but I'll delve into it right now, just some things I thought about it. I loved watching the action during the afternoon during bad weather days. And we'll bring this up as well. We had some really rough weather over the past month here in Atlanta. If you saw the ice storms and the snowstorms that we were dealing with nationally, yeah, it was a bad situation, pretty much being stuck at home for 2-3 days at a time. And luckily for my family, we were all safe and sound, thankfully, and all of that stuff. But what that meant is that you were stuck in the house. Thankfully, it was an Olympic season, so I was able to watch my figure skating and curling and ice hockey while working from home at 11 a.m. or at 1 p.m. in the afternoon. So I was really excited to see some of that stuff. The Tara Lipinski and Johnny Weir situation, watching them do their Olympic broadcasting of the figure skating, it was very interesting because I must admit I'm not necessarily a fan of the sport, but once again, I like sports in general. When you're inside and it's snowing and you can't leave your house because it's literally just an ice slick road outside of on your driveway, you end up watching some unique things. And I thought they had some good humor. They were kind of making fun of themselves, and they knew about the skaters and talked about all the twists and turns and jumps and all that stuff. I was really intrigued by that. And I liked it because while it was professionally done and they hit the high notes of what you're supposed to, they had a very loose interpretation of it. And that's why I would love to see more in broadcasting. It seems like the more I watch broadcasters now, it's kind of from the same schooling and same book. And while I may critique the Dick Vitales and Bill Waltons for being a little too out there and a little too energetic, at least they have personality and they bring something different to the table. Seems like a lot of the broadcasters, and honestly, a lot of it is not their fault. I've met some broadcasters over time, I'm not going to mention names specifically of anybody, but you'll talk with them and you'll see their personalities and they're really outgoing and have some good thoughts, and you'll think, wow, why don't they act like that when they're doing a broadcast? The politics that be, obviously, are the networks, and they want a certain product put out there, and they don't want the announcers to freelance or diversify from the topic at hand and make sure they push certain products and all of this stuff. And I thought that since they were on, Lipinski and Weir were in that afternoon time slot, they weren't prime time, they're able to do a little bit more with their product, and I enjoyed seeing that. And then finally, the Winter Olympics, I've never ice skated or gone skiing before, so obviously I don't have a first-hand reference to it in comparison to the Summer Olympics, where I've done a decent amount of those activities. Like, I've swam before, I've played basketball, and I played tennis, and go down the line. But I like the uniqueness of the events. That's why almost every day I would come home and watch curling. I've never curled a day in my life. I've done shuffleboard. But I like seeing the different sports. And I don't mind if an American does not win the competition. If an American isn't, of course I'd like to see an American win an event that they're in. I'm an American. I love my country and I love the athletes. But if it's the biathlon or speed skating, and there's some Norwegians or Dutch participants in it, or someone from Finland or Sweden, that's not going to affect me from enjoying the essence of the sport. I found as much appreciation of watching some of the Norwegian cross-country skiers as watching a USA hockey team. I had more of a personal interest in the USA hockey team winning because I follow hockey extensively, and I wanted to see them do well. But them not winning the bronze medal game against Finland is not going to deter me from appreciating seeing a biathlete or seeing a ski jumper or a downhill skier performing at a high level if they're not an American. So that's where my view of the sport is different than a lot of other people, and I still found excitement in the event. Daytona 500, and that was a few weeks ago, but seeing Dale Earnhardt Jr. win is great for a NASCAR. I've slacked on my NASCAR viewing over the past few years because it seems like it's Jimmy Johnson's going to win, or it's like one or two people that you can name that are going to be involved in the race and winning the contest, and that doesn't bring interest to me. NASCAR or auto racing in general is not on my top list of following sports. I followed a bit, but I'd like to see some different faces in there. And while Dale Earnhardt Jr. is not a different face, he's been on the circuit for more than 10 years, and I think beyond that, it's good to see him get the win and maybe be in title contention. I'm interested in him. I like seeing him race. So it's good seeing him win the Daytona 500, and you know, we'll see some more stuff there. Next show, I'm going to delve in more into the WWE Network. I know some of you know my intense interest in professional wrestling. I've gotten the question from several of you. Have you gotten the WWE Network? What do you think of it? Have you watched it? Oh, yes. I have watched it. It is glorious. As a matter of fact, after this podcast, after I wrap my stuff up, I'm probably going to go into the network and sign on to it to watch some NXT action or some wrestling programming. I won't get into the specifics of the shows because I know a lot of you don't necessarily follow the product. So I enjoy it a lot. They did a very good job with it. There are some things that could be improved on, but the potential for it is outstanding. So just to answer your questions there, yes, I've seen it. It is great. And then finally, on a personal note, I've been able to, since our last time talking about 4 weeks ago, I've been able to see Atlanta a little bit more, and the weather's getting better, so I'm going to really go out there a little bit more and see the city. Got to get the little Five Points. I love that part of town in East Atlanta. I was able to do some music shopping at Criminal Records. I went to some good organic food stores. And been doing my research trying to get my food content right, get that together. Really interesting scene. I saw some protest. I saw some, I think, African Christians who were arguing with some people who were not Christians. And that brought me back to my New York days. In New York, we had the African Israelites, or the African Jews, we call them that. And they would have verbal confrontations against people who were not Christian. And they should have charged for it. Because you would see the shouting matches go on for hours of different people from different religious backgrounds just shouting at each other. Unfortunately, sometimes it would get to come to blows, excuse me, and you would see some bad stuff go on. But I enjoyed seeing that in Little Five Points. Excuse me. So I've done that. Going to see some plays coming up over the next few weeks. The theater scene is going to pick up here in Atlanta. I'm excited about that. And overall, as I said, I've just been able to see the city a little bit more. So every time I go somewhere, and maybe I'll preview where I'm going if I know exactly where it is, and we can meet up and you can actually see my face and match it with my voice. And I think that'd be good for everybody. And on our next show, we're going to delve into more of the NBA, discuss that. I'm going to also go into the topic of NCAA basketball. There seems to be a divide between the people following the freshman class and seniors, and viewing the scope from a perspective of the NBA. I'm going to go into that a little bit more in depth on my next episode, because I saw a little Twitter debate going on right when I was setting up for today's show. We've seen certain seniors like a Doug McDermott from Creighton, Kilpatrick from Cincinnati, Aaron Kraft from Ohio State, seniors forming at a high level, and there seems to be a media push to elevate their skills as an affront to the freshman hype, or the hype that we've seen from the freshman class. And you seem to have old school or older and strictly college basketball writers who want to focus on just the seniors and their virtues and their values. And they're very high, and I agree with that. But they seem to undermine the follower who looks towards the future, towards NBA potential. I'm going to analyze that a lot more on Wednesday, and it'll make more sense when I go into that. And finally, on my next show, we're going to talk about the Major League Baseball. Starts up in a few weeks. Spring training is in full swing. We're going to go into the AL East and the NL East. Or we may switch it up. I think what I'm going to do, I'll make an executive decision here, that we're going to do some cross promotion. We're going to do some AL East and NL Central. That's what we'll do. And that makes sense because the World Series teams from this past season, the Boston Red Sox and the St. Louis Cardinals, are in those two divisions. So we'll start with the NL champs and the AL champs, and that'll be in the preview of the next show. But before we go, I'm going to get into what ruffled my feathers over the past few weeks. probably the two biggest crossover stories in the world of sports have been things going on off the field since the last time we spoke. Since the last podcast I did, we've had two events take place. Jason Collins, obviously, he admitted a few months ago that he was homosexual, and since that time, since the last time I did a show, he signed with the Brooklyn Nets with a contract. Michael Sam, an NFL prospect, a defensive player out of the University of Missouri, he came out and admitted he was homosexual. It brought up the overbearing interest in homosexuality within sports. I really have not understood the media overbearingness of this. They're not the two first homosexuals to play in sports, and they will not be the last. I've covered and worked with gay athletes in college and professional sports. It is not as unique as you think. I honestly don't even feel comfortable. I'm a little bit disappointed in myself for making this a segment from Ruffling My Feathers. Because usually when I do this section, it's something that is negative and something that has annoyed me. Those two have not annoyed me. The media attention to them has. The fact that it is the lead story on the sports world does disappoint me. It's 2014. If you have not had a coworker, a roommate, a friend, a family member, or never interacted with a homosexual, you need to reevaluate your lifestyle. And if you can say to yourself that I have never been in that world, you are lying to yourself. Hopefully this won't be a major story in the future. Hopefully we can look at these situations where a player's sexual preference may come out in an official way or unofficial way, and it does not concern us one bit. Now, I know that may be a utopian way of looking at the world and looking at sports, but I think in the future, as a new generation comes into form, and I see it with my younger family members and younger people I follow that are in their 20s, I think we're all becoming more official and more aware of the realities of people's lifestyles. And I really think that if you can play or you can ball in whatever sport it is, I think in the end that wins out. Once again, thank you for listening to my show. We're going to be on, as I said, on Wednesday. That show will be online in several forms. Follow us on Twitter under Sports Inquirer, all one word. On Facebook under The Sports Inquirer, those are separate words, and follow us on iTunes under The Sports Inquirer. Send us an email under sportsinquirer@gmail.com. And until then, have a good week, good fight, good night.